Okay, right. Welcome to episode 35 of the Never Iron Anything podcast, an occasional review show where we talk about a comic or a series chosen by one of the guests. My name's Tony Esmond. I have two returning guests who are both actually collaborators and creators individually in their own rights. This week we have the Renegade Masters that are Johnny Cannon and James McCulloch. Hello, guys.
Hey, how you doing, man? How you doing?
Good. Where is it? Oh, don't be like all down. You were just excited a second ago. You sounded upper. Now you're down.
I'm talking to me.
Yeah.
I'm damn top.
You appeared almost.
So high.
You literally.
We're talking about Tony.
He cosplayed as a wrestler a minute ago. The left your camera on far too long. But yeah, okay, good. It's good to have you back, guys. Good. And we're going to talk a bit about what you've got, on the go, on the boil, in a bit. I'm going to leave it to James. James, are you going to, because you came up with this idea. So what have you chosen for us to read this week? Read and talk about.
The Judge Dredd story, America, by John Wagner and Colin McNeil.
Cool. Now, for those that are listening, we've chosen just to do the first one. We all own the continuing saga, but I think we all decided individually and came together with the opinion that we'll just do the first one. That's right, guys, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the best one by quite a long way. Not that it gets rubbish after, but I think it says everything needs to.
Yeah, okay.
It doesn't, you know, the other bits are just because it was popular. It's like when Chopper kept coming back. You know, it's like there was no need for Chopper to come back. You know, he died about three times by that point, but this kept bringing him back. You know,
yeah, you can only leave the village once, can't you? Let's face it. As a prisoner analogy. So, like you say, scripted by John Wagner, art by Colin McNeil, letters by Annie Parkhouse. It came out. In 1990, and was the first Dredd story in the Judge Dredd magazine, or it was in the first
this
issue.
This is when it was a smaller size, wasn't it?
I can't remember.
I'm sure when Judge Dredd magazine came out, I remember at one point it came out and it was like almost like an American comic size. But that's a total digression. But I just remember when it came out.
I'm not sure about that one, maybe. But trying to think back, my first encounter with it was. Buying that magazine when it came out, because it was quite a big deal back then that we kind of had this sort of, it became like a monthly magazine, which is still going in a sort of slightly new incarnation. Is that where you first saw it, was it, James?
Yeah, it was Judge Dredd magazine. That's where I first saw it, because it was really exciting, because I mean it was about the time of Crisis and stuff as well, so it was just when there was like this big kind of, you know, excitement about British comics in general.
Yeah, there's a little bit of the danger on the comic shelves in the newsagents back then, wasn't there? Like you say, we had Crisis and we had Toxic and we had Deadline and Escape and all that sort of little period, really, in British comics, wasn't it? Yeah. What about you, Mr. P?
This is the first time I read it. I mean, I didn't really read 2000 AD when I was a kid, because I was really into Marvel first, Marvel UK, then Marvel US.
Right.
The time I really saw Judge Dredd was if I was going for a haircut and if there was a Daily Star sitting there.
Okay.
I would read the Judge Dredd newspaper strip. So for me, I may be a bit odd, because for me, the definitive Judge Dredd artist is Ron Smith. I absolutely love Ron Smith.
I've got him written down to talk about later, actually. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll talk about our favourite Dredd. I've got a little question for you about who your favourite Dredd artists are in a bit, but. Did you want to give a little summary, or should we talk? I'll tell you what we'll do to start with. Let's start with the question that I sent you, that I'd like to pose you, is who is Dredd to you guys? So should we start with you, James? Who do you feel he is? There's a lot of talk about, is he a villain? Is he the good guy? Is he, you know, what is he when you read him?
He's just an asshole, isn't he? No, I mean, for me, Dredd's just this totalitarian kind of like authoritative figure that... he's not a good guy. He's never been a good guy. I mean, it's funny because they do kind of have stories of him where he is kind of like painted this kind of quite heroic figure, you know, like especially like just now what's going on in 2000 AD. I think it's the Day of Reckoning or whatever it's called. I can't remember. But he's quite like this big heroic kind of figure. Like he's like at the end of his career and he's like this heroic kind of guy. But he's not a heroic guy. He's never been heroic. The whole point of Dredd is that he squashes people into fitting in a system that doesn't really work.
Okay.
And that's kind of the point. So for me, that's why I've liked it. And that's why I like America. Not that that's what we're talking about, but it's actually, because that's where we're here. But I've always liked America because it's all about the other people. And for me, like, whenever I write a Dread story, which I have done in the past, because that's what you fucking do, isn't it, when you write comics, you write things that you'll never get published. But they're never about Dread, they're about people around them. Because I find that story much more fascinating than actual Dread, because Dread himself, although he's a great character, even John Wagner, I'm sure, would admit that he's a total dick, and he's a total, authoritative figure that is quite oppressing people, ultimately,
Yeah, no, I get that, and he's tackled in different ways, isn't he? He's sometimes the like the city's the star, sometimes the the people around him, sometimes he's the star, and they do play him off occasionally as a hero. But I know the Apocalypse War didn't end well, but his stories like that occasionally. What about you, Johnny? Who do you think he is to you? Is he? Have you read much
I
Dread?
think, yeah, no, so, I mean, even though I didn't really read it when I was growing up, one of my best mates, when I was a teenager, he was really into 2000 AD,
Right.
and I used to borrow 2000 AD off him to read Zenith. So, I mean, I loved superheroes, I was used to reading that. And in that, and I started getting, probably like a lot of folk, the best of 2000 AD, the monthly. Was it monthly? No, was that weekly? I can't remember. But it's
That was
Slane in the
monthly,
first few
yeah.
issues, and like a lot of Mick McMahon stuff, and I absolutely loved that, and the VCs, and there was Dread in that. And I had, when I was a kid, oh God, I can't remember what year it is. I had a 2000 AD annual in that, and it reprinted, I think it was the first 2000 AD story. It was the one that Carlos Escuera did but didn't get published, and they published
Okay,
the Mick McMahon
right.
one first. And that was reprinted in an annual. And to be honest, I found Dread probably one of the least interesting characters in it. I mean, I preferred Mac 1, Strontium Dog, Rogue Trooper, and I think that's because in many ways he's not. He's more of a symbol than a character. He's not heroic, he's mythic.
Yeah.
Like James said, he's ended his career as a legend that's built up. To me, it was quite interesting reading American that he's seen as this kind of unflinching symbol of the law, and to me, he's absolutely not. I think it's an interesting part of the character is he's very hypocritical, and I think the character is what the story needs him to be to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And it's natural if you're writing a character over that length of time and he's aging in real time, there's going to be a degree of, it's not inconsistency, but or even evolution in the character. It's just everyone's contradictory to some extent, but this unflinching symbol of the law isn't really, because there's a part, and obviously we'll come to it, it said, oh, do you want him to lock him up in an ISO cube? And he's like, no, he's suffered enough. And you're like, really?
That I
Aren't you
found
meant
that
to
a
be the
strange
law?
point. I think the thing is,
That's more about justice than the law, though, which is interesting,
yeah,
and I think
that's
that's an interesting
certainly a
question.
theme, dude. Yeah, completely. I think it's interesting because John Wagner used to say that he wrote story. He'd look at if he had trouble thinking up a story, he'd look at CFAX, and whatever was on CFAX, he'd turn it into a Dread story. So I suppose if you're going to look at, I don't know, the miners' strike, and you think, how can I fit Dread into that one? There needs to be a little
Yeah.
bent, little bit of a bending of the myth occasionally, I think, you know.
God, CFAX, man, that takes me back. I used to really like watching CFAX when I was drunk. It was really quite weird. Like going out at like two in the morning. Seriously, CFAX on
Everyone
Teletext.
loved the game as well. What the fuck was that again? Remember the game when the game came on and you were like fucking,
Yeah. And it took ages for the play. You used to have to wait for the page to come back around if you just missed it.
Oh, right,
Oh,
right.
man.
Okay, the game. Oh, sorry, yeah. I
Yeah.
used to watch
Yeah,
the
you had the, yeah, the
boxing
buttons
coverage
and
on it as well. And it was like, you get it like page five, and it's like, oh, bloody hell, he's been knocked out. And you're like, hang on, if he's knocked out in page five, what's page seven? What are they telling you in page seven? He's knocked out in page five.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the story. So, the plot, I'll try and summarize it. It's a little bit, it goes round a bit, doesn't it? So, America Java, aka Ami, and Benny Beanie are kids in the big city. At one point, they encounter the judges, a judge. They haven't done anything too serious, but they get off with him just sort of giving them a hard stare, like a Paddington hard stare, in order to sort of put them in their place. But America, in the end, joins, I suppose, what we'd call a domestic terrorist group now, wouldn't we? After a march. What did you think of though the early part of the story there? It's a strange one to me. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, for me, it's kind of like it's just a refugee story, isn't it, at the beginning? It's like kind of a
Yeah.
refugee story. It could be placed now. It doesn't need to be Mega City One. It could be right now that
Yeah.
it's set in, especially with the light of everything that's been happening in America
Yeah,
the
with the
last few
protest
months.
movement, it's quite a book. It's caught us at the right time, isn't it, to read it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, definitely. The kids and that, and they're approached by Dread and everything. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, it's. I think I've written in my notes. It's an aggressively paramilitary, social, and political landscape at the time in there, isn't it? And let's face it, it's not that much different now.
No. Yeah. That was that's a really nice word in there, Tony. I'm pleased you wrote that down because I'm a few vodkas in and
But the story spans their lives, so I think we've got to mention at some point the emphasis that is put on this story as being one of the best Dredd stories. And it's forever quoted in the top 10 best 2000 AD best Dredd stories, isn't it?
And it's funny because, as you were saying earlier, sorry, I'm totally taking over, Johnny. I do apologize, but like, there's often in this where Dredd doesn't act like Dredd in this story,
and Dredd's not in it much.
Like, he's not. No, he's hardly in it, and he constantly does things like, yeah, he's had enough today, it's fine, or yeah, we'll just let him go, it's all right. You know, and there's constant bits for that where you're like, that's not something Dredd would do. That's not, if you read any other Dredd story, that's not what's happening.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And, but what it does, it kind of spans a bit of the history. So we get the Meg versus Sov War, don't we? The Apocalypse War in the background, in summarized in one full page spread. And their lives divide. So Benny and America's lives divide. He becomes a singer, a sort of comedy singer. And she sort of disappears off and is thought to be dead for quite a long time, isn't she? And he comes across her as a sort of street level hooker, pretending to be a hooker in order to lure judges in to kill them. And she's now part of an organization called Total War. Benny gets caught in the ambush, but he survives. And he lies to Dredd about what happens initially to protect America. So he is that sort of long lost love. He's always, you know, sought her out. He's fully in love with her, and she's a sort of something of a wild child, I suppose. Is that a good description, or Johnny?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
I think it's quite interesting because After I read it, I thought, right, I can see why James has picked this, because, like you say, it really resonates with the times just now, you know, and that debate about that's not just happening in the US, but over here as well, perhaps a lesser extent, about where sort of democracy ends and where fascism starts.
Yeah.
And I guess that's been around since 2000 AD was... Actually, no, it doesn't, because it was 76, wasn't it? So it predated Thatcher, but
When you think this was written, this came out in 90, what did we have? I suppose we had the poll tax riots and stuff around there, didn't we? We were just post the miners' riots. There was the print riots in East London, you know, the big fights there. Yep. It was in the air definitely at the time, wasn't it?
I don't think it's just that as well. And I think this is something that I was going to mention when we got around to talking about the art, is I think there's a definite tonal shift here. And I did a bit of reading. I was quite surprised when I read the reviews about this, about the types of things they focus on. They focus on the, that kind of democracy versus fascism, the politics. And to me, this story, reading it, is a very straightforward noir story.
Okay, interesting.
Because there's a first-person narrative, I mean, you know, from two different perspectives, admittedly. First-person narrative, but also there's a femme fatale in it. And also there's a twist, which is, to me, instantly reminded me of a noir film which came out 2 years after this. So I mean, there's
right,
to me it's a noir story set against this geopolitical backdrop.
Yeah.
And I found that quite interesting, and the thing that actually leapt out to me was the kind of psychosexual obsession, to me, is one of the main themes in it, as much as the politics.
Okay.
I found it fascinating when I was reading the review, and it was talking about this as a love story, and heard Colin McNeil talking about it as a love story and stuff, and I was like, this isn't a love story, this is about an obsessive person.
Yeah, I was always... I mean,
she uses him as well, you know.
Yeah,
she
that's my cynical opinion of it. As a cynic coming into it, I'm thinking she has sex with him to get the money out of him to buy the explosives, and he turns the tables. Yeah. But there's that, right, man, that noir, that trope in noir of the duplicitous woman, you know, oh, please, you know, I'll have sex with you. And then she asked him to kill, you know, it's like the old Wayne's World 2 joke, isn't it? And then, will you kill my husband? It's like that, isn't it? You know.
I mean, there's even stuff in there as well. And I don't know if this is purposeful, but in the kind of early part, I mean, when they're talking about life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, the three great principles upon which our ancient nation was founded. Like, and then there's the kind of hollow image of Thomas Jefferson. I mean, Thomas Jefferson was many things, and one of them was, you know, he was obviously a very controversial figure for his relationship with slavery, and also his relationship with, was it Sally Hemings?
I'm not sure, mate.
As well. So it's I don't know how much of that's purposeful. I think there's some aspects of this which I think are great, and I think that then there's some things which possibly haven't aged that well.
Yeah. We're talking,
which really leapt out.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because part of that is the ending, I think. Yeah,
yes,
I what you're saying.
Absolutely, absolutely.
One of the things... Sorry, mate, go on.
Sorry. I was going to say, I think the end is made even worse by the second part.
Okay.
That we're not talking about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it makes it even worse, which is why I don't want to really talk about it, you know, because it's just...
The other thing that bears talking about is the fascist America situation with it. So she has a baby and has been in a psych ward, and there's a genetic abnormality, and they kill it without asking her. And there's that parallel with race, and you know,
yes,
because the muties are always, to me, politically the underclass in the city, weren't they? The ones they were like the Mexicans who were thrown out of New York, you know, out of LA, and this sort of thing. There's an element to that, yeah. I think one of the main reasons that it's perhaps remembered so fondly is the opening dialogue, isn't it? I suppose. There's the famous monologue by Dredd at the start, which starts with, "Where do I stand? I'll tell you where I stand," that thing. I wonder whether that's... And it's very well written, that. "I stand four square for justice. I stand for discipline, good order, and the rigid application of the law." It's a really well... I mean, it's a well-written book, actually. I have to say, I like a lot of what Wagner does with the dialogue and the narration in it. Yeah.
No, I mean, there is something special about it. The fact that the narration goes on throughout it as well, it's not like, you know how some books, they overdo narration?
Yeah.
And it's like they use narration as an excuse to not tell you the story, or they use narration as an excuse, like a soap opera where it's like, "Hey, yeah, I'm going to do this now, and this is what's happening," and then you see them in the picture doing that and doing this thing. But the narration in this book is beautiful. It does make the story flow, and it doesn't hamper the story in any way. It doesn't get in the way of the story. It adds to it, and it lets it flow naturally, and makes you jump and span time in such a way that you wouldn't think if it wasn't there.
Yeah, I think so. It's encapsulated for me as part of the dialogue, part of the narration. There is, "Justice has a price, and the price is freedom," and that's the sense of freedom throughout it is a big theme, isn't it? Whether she's free, whether he's free, you know, he turns his back on it for some time, doesn't he? And he certainly turns his back on his freedom at the end there. The nature of freedom in America and freedom in the UK, and whether we are entitled to protest about stuff. Yeah, but it's so resonant now. I know we've said it before, but it really is, isn't it?
It's quite funny you're saying that about the narration and how it doesn't get in the way. I think that's partly because one thing that struck me when I was reading it, was when I was looking at that, was there's quite a few money shots through it. And just for anyone that doesn't know, like, that's kind of a term that I guess it was coined for the kind of image style of drawing, like a lot of splash pages.
Yeah,
that's true,
man.
You know, the main character posing and stuff, and it's almost like a pin-up in the story. So when you've got that narration that sits on top of that, it doesn't get in the way because there's no action.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's a static image and stuff, so it really fits. And there's a number of pages like that, which is interesting.
Yeah, some of the splash pages are phenomenal. And they're proper... The way they use the splash pages in this, I think, is quite clever, is that they're moments where you're like, holy shit. They're holy shit moments, you know what I mean? Like, as you progress, like, it's the judge getting shot. And then it's, you know, when the judges just start shooting the guy that's her pal, that's doing the crime that Benny's dobbed him in for and stuff. Yeah. You know, the splash pages are all done really, really well, which, you know... isn't like a lot of the image books.
they're possibly quite a lot of them are there for a reason. I have to say, the one that I find slightly under rendered is the war came, it was Mega City, to when it started, I sat it out there, you know, the Sov page.
That one's the one, actually, one that makes no sense as being a splash page, because as you say, it is totally underutilized, and there's so much stuff they could have put in it that's just not there. It's actually quite... It didn't need to be a splash page. It could have easily have been something else.
It seems to just be crammed in the bottom third almost, without... I wasn't quite as fond of that. But like you say, the one where the judge gets shot, you know, through the back and out the chest is an incredible shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, really good. Yeah.
And it's quite interesting when you see that one as well, because... it didn't take me at the story at all. So I was just trying to find it. I don't think there's any blood in that.
There's not, no.
No, there's not, which actually makes it even more evocative, because ordinarily, I mean, I think probably because particularly since 2000 AD, the magazine, as far as I know, was aimed at an older audience. I think
it actually followed
Revolver. Revolver had come out earlier on that year. This came out in October, and Revolver had come out in the out in July.
Oh, I like Revolver. It's good. Yeah.
So one thing that I think probably if you're doing something like that, I think he's done. In fact, I know because I listened to an interview with him. So, but it looks like, I mean, he's used acrylics and then he airbrushed some of it as well. But for that ordinarily, I think what quite a few people would be tempted to do, and I'd be tempted to do, would be to do a splatter. So you just get a toothbrush and spray either paint or ink to show blood's going everywhere. Okay. But because it's not got that, it's the image is so clean, it's even more shocking. Do you know what I mean? And it's even expression, his face is relatively understated. I mean, that could be Dredd.
Yeah, it really could be, couldn't it? Yeah.
It takes a minute to actually realise it's not Dredd. I think when you're reading it, you have to double check and you have to check the badge. Oh my God, is that Dredd? But that's the funny thing, actually, looking at the page later on where the guy gets really, really shot, there's not much, is blood in that as well, but there's not much blood. Most of it is actual flare from the bullet and the gun. You know what I mean? It's not, because if that was like Bisley, for example, there'd been blood all over the place with that.
Yeah,
you know?
I do think there's a little bit of a Bisley influence here, though, I have to say. But that carried on through quite a few artists and quite a few years before this even came out. I'm a creature of, I started reading 2000 AD like a year into it, sort of thing. And I'm a bigger fan of the black and white and the sort of perhaps more traditional line and colouring styles they'd use, you know, Esquire and Bolland and all that sort of thing. And like you say, Ron Smith. But when this Bisley and all that firm started, I'm like, oh. And
yeah, it became an almost, it's not an in-house, it wasn't an in-house style, but an in-house medium, where it was almost kind of, yeah, that kind of metal.
Yeah, it's a good description.
How do you pronounce it? Metal Hurlon? Hurlon? Still, but I think a big influence in this probably was, I don't know if it was, I wonder, Electra Lives Again was published in March 1990.
Right.
Which means Daredevil. I wonder if Electra Assassin, I think, might have been out before that.
I can't remember now. Sienkiewicz was
using mixed media. Dark Knight Returns, certainly the tone.
Well, he'd already used it in New Mutants, hadn't he, and stuff.
So that was definitely there in comics. And I wonder if that, as much, I mean, I know people talk a lot about the European influence with Bisley, but certainly guys like fucking Liam Sharp.
Yep.
With assistance for Don Lawrence. So that painterly style has always been there in British comics because there was a kind of funny comics on one side with Ken Reed and Leo Baxendale, and then the other side you had Don Lawrence, Frank Hampson, guys that were phenomenal painters. But there is something different about this. It's painted cartooning.
And
Bisley's face is grotesque. This isn't grotesque to me. This is still relatively realistic.
It's just about on the side that I can deal with it. The only failing I have in it, for me, perhaps at the age of reading it, I think probably less so now, is the way he uses a lot of one colour on panels. So there's quite a few striking pages, just ones in green. There's quite a few panels that are just done in yellow. And I'm not overly sure why. And I can only, was it a time thing? I don't know. I would rather have seen everything totally coloured.
It might be colour theory. So if you look through it, like there's a page, there's a kind of, like there's a use of a kind of purple through it. Like America wears purple when she's born.
Right.
There's a purple.
Okay.
Or dad's in purple highlights. And then there's the block that they live in is purple.
Which is Friedrich Nietzsche block, wasn't it? Don't forget as well. Yeah.
Purple. And then if you go to the end, like at the twist, I'm sure it's a purple dress. It's a darker purple dress.
Yeah.
And the judges are in purple when someone's been shot. So there's a lot of there's purple used as a highlight for key scenes. She's wearing purple at the key scene with the judge being shot as well. Yeah. So that I think it's color theory, that's been applied there. But you're right, there's some pages like Benny's wearing the green and white, and then a judge is spying on them, and it's a green enhanced image as well. So there's it's colours which are used consistently. There's quite a lot of oranges in there as well. I wonder when he goes through the script. I don't use colour because I'm garbage at it. But one thing I would do is I would probably, I would colour code it. I would just highlight keywords so that for that panel, I know it's going to be predominantly greens. And I think it works better if you've got scenes with a strong colour on it. If you've got just panels, it doesn't work quite so well because it can look a bit, I don't know. I would describe this in some places as neon noir.
Yeah,
actually.
Very much so. Yeah, it's definitely right. That, which is the 80s and 90s, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, I mean, it starts as well. It starts bright, quite colourful as well. Like you're saying, it's quite purple, but it gets more muted as it goes on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's very, it becomes very muted. And as it's almost like as Mega City becomes more of an oppressive force within the comic and within what's happening, it seems more of an oppressive like presence. It gets more and more muted. And it's only really when Benny and America are together that it kind of has some colour there. Because anytime you see the city, it's very, as you say, it's very, it's like the old purples or blues or you know, there's a bit of green there or whatever, like towards the end where it's just all blue, the Statue of Liberty's in the background, but the background's all just blues and it's just red in the front with a little bit of colour.
Yeah. The city seems more spacious than what I'm used to in this as well. I'm used to that sort of claustrophobic small streets beneath, you know, huge skyscrapers and blocks and stuff. But this one, even when he goes and lives the rich life, he lives on a, almost like a house on its own, which I found a...
Yeah, I've never seen that. Yeah, I've never seen that before in any 2080. Like, you know, that's a point. Yeah.
It's a strange one.
Yeah, that kind of, that fascinated me as well, because I think what one thing, when you mentioned that splash page earlier on, like about that reference Apocalypse War, I think maybe what took you out of it is he's used, I can't remember the Sov Colonel's name.
Oh, I can't remember either.
He's used
a
Carlos Esquerra image as reference. It's not Colin
McNeil.
Yeah. It is Carlos Esquerra. And that happens a couple of times.
And the robots, the robot fighting machines are as well, I think.
Yeah. I mean, but that's
his story, so,
But the face is very much an Esquerra face. And some of his designs of his buildings, I remember listening to the 2080 Thrillcast, and they were interviewing Carlos Esquerra, and Mike Mulcher was laughing, saying, your buildings look like, and the square was laughing, he's like, big penises.
Yeah.
Whereas some people draw them as skyscrapers. I think it's Bolland started drawing them as skyscrapers, as like big rectangles and stuff. And in this, in some cases, it's just, it could be Brooklyn, do you know what I mean? Like in the 80s, like in the 70s.
Yeah, it could be Escape from New York, couldn't it? Or it could be the Warriors even at certain points in this. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? So, I mean, we talked a little bit about what genre is, and it's kind of a complicated one genre-wise. I mean, it's science fiction, but it's a romance. Is it a romance, but it's a noir? It just seems to me to be a strange brew to be the first story. What do you think about that?
It's almost like they were trying to make a statement.
Right. Well, this is an adult book.
This is an adult book, and it's not the Dredd stories you're used to. Mm. This isn't the Judge Dredd of 2008. This is a more adult Dredd. We're looking at subject things that we wouldn't look at in 2008. They're definitely making a statement that this is a different entity than the character you see in 2008. That's what I got from it at the time. Yeah. You know.
Shall we move? Let's talk a little bit about 2000 AD and Dredd art in particular. So, right, I'm going to give you a task here. So I'm going to say you're not allowed to say Bolland, Esquerra or McMahon. And we've already had Ron Smith. So who would be your more favourite Dredd artist? Who would be your go-tos? So you'd see him drawing. You might go and buy a collection, for example, but you'd have a flick through to see who was in that particular collection. Would there be anyone that you would automatically buy? I'm going to probably say for me, there's a few. Cam Kennedy, Brett Ewins, Chris Weston. Steve Dillon, and at the moment I really like Dan Cornwell's art. I think he's really good.
Oh, he's really knocking it out of the park
as well. Yeah, he's like a return to the classic thing. What about you, James?
Bizarrely, I really like Siku.
Okay.
You know, is it Siku? Siku, I really liked his stuff, but I think it was because it was very 90s at the time, I think, but it just really worked for me. I remember reading it, and because he took a slightly different take on Dredd, and I always like guys that do a slightly different take.
Yeah.
On him, because
that's why McMahon stood out for me so much. McMahon was and Brett Ewins, and you know, McCarthy, even these sort of people, they had their own, they owned it, didn't they, whenever they drew it.
Oh, totally. I mean, but that's what you need. I mean, like, Dredd's been around so long, you need someone to take it and do something else with it that make it exciting again. Otherwise, you're just it looks like you're reading the same book that you read already, but you want something interesting.
Yeah. It's like you mentioned Ron Smith, Johnny. He's got... There's a nastiness to his work. There's a... I found him fucking frightening, some of the stuff he did as a kid.
There's a grotesqueness. Yeah. So the reason why I like Ron Smith is he's got the polished ink line and the beautiful line weight of Brian Bolland, but there's a grotesquery to it. Yeah. I mean, the way he draws teeth, I sometimes do that when I'm drawing as well, because it gives, particularly if you're drawing someone screaming, make the teeth, like everyone's got Kylie Minogue teeth, no offence to Kylie Minogue if she's listening, and Ron's misjudged dread. They're slightly too, because this makes me sound like a little lunatic, but they're slightly too pronounced for their mouth.
Yeah.
I really like that, and I think the modern guy, I think that, I don't know if he's drawing Judge Dredd. I know he's drawing, wasn't Judge Anderson? Oh God, what was it? I've not actually read it. I've only picked it up or seen it online. Tom Foster, the guy from Edinburgh.
Okay.
He's very like Bolland.
Right.
That very polished, lush inking style. But I saw it in colour in 2000 AD, in a trade, and I much, much prefer it in black and white. But Brian Bolland's work in Judge Dredd, I don't like seeing it in colour. I like seeing it in black and white.
Yeah,
same with Ron Smith. To me, I think, and again, I don't know if it's because of there's almost a, it's not just fascism, it's there's a very kind of objectivist, something very Randian about Dredd's world as well.
Okay.
I mean, I've not read there as much as you guys. Yeah. I mean, I've read the first seven case files. I really like the early stuff, and it's because I much prefer 2000 AD in black and white.
Yeah.
It's just reflecting my age. I mean, you've spoken about this before. Like, you know, I read Marvel UK and you know, it's predominantly black and white. I that's why I draw black and white comics. There's just something about it that really speaks to me.
A lot of these are like Ron Smith and like Mike McMahon, and also like Ballard and Ellie, they just work so much better in black and white. There's a, like you say, there's that grotesque, aggressive, transgressive, dangerous feeling to their work. You know, Kevin O'Neill's the same, isn't he? Yeah.
But you can't hide anything. It's so much starker.
Yeah.
I suppose you can with excessive noodling. Like if you were to see, fucking hell, I'm just trying to think what Jeff Darrow's artwork would look like in black and white. You'd be like, because there's
It'd be too much, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Same line weight. You just go, oh my god, you can't process.
Yeah.
So I think it's Dave Stewart. He does a lot of the heavy lifting in that, which Darrow said himself. But it'd be interesting to see what Colin McNeill's pencils were like in this.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the heavy lifting.
Yeah, would
is
be really would be, wouldn't it? Yeah. I mean, I'm presuming he's a guy who works digitally now. He looks like he's that would be an easy transition for me between this and a digital style. Or what do you think?
I don't know. I think we've spoken about this before, that I think sometimes with digital art, it can fall into a trap of looking very much the same. Like there's a massive school of kind of very animation.
Yeah,
influence,
there is. Yeah,
manga, yeah. Anime influence as well in comics, and it's, you know, I appreciate that, and I think some of it's incredibly well done, and I couldn't draw that well myself, but it's just not my bag. I prefer something that's a bit more naturalistic, more kind of old school comics. I like Colin McNeill's stuff. It's not a dislike. I much prefer Ron Smith, Brian Bolland. That to me is Dredd, that kind of style. But again, Mick McMahon's nothing like that. Square is nothing like that. So it's a very versatile character and a versatile world, because Mega City 1 changes architecture.
Yeah.
Story to story.
What are you going to say, Jim?
No, I was just going to say that the Colin McNeill's work on Chopper, the black and white story done for Chopper, was phenomenal.
Yeah,
like, you know, his black and white stuff is really, really good.
A wee bit like Barry Kitson, but with a much...
I like that. I like Barry Kitson as well, and I get that totally.
He's got those button noses.
Kitson's a bit cleaner, isn't he, I think? Yeah.
Because one of the things I was going to say, agreeing with what you were saying about the Marvel books as well, is a lot of the time it just seems rushed, Marvel books now. Like, I don't really buy Marvel comics anymore, and I haven't done for quite a while, because the artwork is so just horrendous and glossy. It's like that weird computer generated thing you're seeing. It's just, it's too much. I mean, there's the guy I used to obviously work in care for years, and this guy that I looked after, and he wanted to get some Spider-Man comics and Iron Man comic or whatever, so I got him some stuff, and it was like there was one page and there was hardly any images. It was literally Two people walking up to a building. The building took up the whole thing, and then it was, and then there was a face, and it was just surrounded by dialogue, and you couldn't even see half the people who were
Right.
talking in it.
Yeah.
And you're like, the fuck's the point in that? You know what I mean? You can't really follow the story, and I think that's when you're doing the comics the way that they do them in Marvel and stuff. When they're just pumping out comics, it's like an assembly line. They're just pumping it like some of the comics are like two a month.
Yeah.
There's no way as an artist that you can keep up with that
And
without
it's a change. There's
putting your
occasional
best work
change
in,
in
you know.
artists, isn't there? It's more and more common. The days of, Mark Bagley doing Ultimate Spider-Man for 110 issues have seemingly gone a bit, and sadly, you know.
I mean, like, there was a thing on the Acts of the Awesome Comics podcast, the wall thing on Facebook, on the Facebook page, about somebody saying how it's disgraceful how you have writers having, like, this writer's version of James Bond or whatever, or
Right.
this is this writer's version of this
Yeah.
person, and it's an omnibus of their work. And it's like, but it's because the artist changes every three fucking issues. You know what I mean? If the artist is changing every 45 issues, then it's harder to, you could say, we'll have, the certain artists, I can't even think of whatever, but you'll have the artist version of Iron Man. But then if it's only like issues 1 to 4 and then 8 to 12, and then you're not going to get the full story, and it becomes a bit.
Yeah. Well, I think
See, to be
Dredd
honest,
has kind of survived that a little bit, though, isn't he? Dredd has survived that artist change because we kind of accepted and we kind of made cool a lot, especially a lot of the early Dredd artists. We were familiar. So you'd pick up the prog from week to week and you go, oh, it's Ron Smith this week, or it's, Brett Ewins or Brendan McCarthy, or whoever it's going to be on whatever strip you're following. It would be, you'd kind of, your eye would work in for them because there was a little band of them almost.
But you got used to that as well, because so I've listened to lately quite a few interviews with Dave Gibbons,
Yeah.
and there was a great one. Again, it was on the Thrillcast with Dave Gibbons, Mick
I
McMahon,
watched that a couple of weeks
and
ago. That
Brian
is a good
Bolland
one. Yeah,
together.
that's funny as fuck
Brian,
as well. Yeah.
oh, they're lovely. It's lovely the way, like,
When they go, they each put a hat
fucking
on.
tease Brian Bolland relentlessly.
Yeah.
It's just, oh, they're brilliant. But Bolland was famously slow. So when it came to do, I mean, I remember when I was reading, it's quite funny because I think for a lot of people, he's the kind of definitive Judge Dredd
I
artist,
think a lot,
particularly, I
especially
think,
for the
for the cover
Americans, I
art
think
as well.
somehow. Yeah.
Yes. I think that's because the quality
Yeah, I
comics,
think
the
you're
Eagle
right.
comics, on your covers, which are stunning. But I remember when I picked up, when I got, I don't know, it's like the second or third case files, and I was reading that, and but the way it'd almost been marketed, it was like, oh, it's Bolland and this, and it's like, God, he draws not that much of it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of McMahon in here, which is great, because I mean, I didn't when I was a kid, I thought I didn't get McMahon, and now when I'm older, I'm like, holy shit, Mick McMahon's amazing. Like, I used to prefer
Oh, me too,
Ballard
man. When Sky Chariots came out, I went, "What the fuck is this?" Yeah.
aye, but
I'm gonna.
Ian Gibson, I thought was
Yeah, I
good.
like Ian Gibson stuff. Yeah, definitely. No, he's great. Robo Hunter stuff is just superb. I know everyone goes about the Halo Jones stuff, but the Robo Hunter stuff I absolutely loved. And another one who was I actually found sort of slightly frightening as a kid. He sort of scared his work scared me a little bit. There was a danger to what he did. I have to say, I actually think I'm not a. I'm gonna be. This is gonna be sacrilege, but I'm not a fan of the art in this. I don't. I think, like you say, like it's hard to figure out which judge is which. I think the kids' faces fall into caricature to the point where I'm not actually sure who was who on an initial scan through. There's
What's Benny's body all about as well, by the way?
yeah, it's
Like,
true.
you know what I mean? Like, no, I'm not really saying funny, but he's a comedic singer that sings comedy songs and dresses in a suit, but he's like ripped to fuck,
Yeah,
you
you
know?
think. And then there's, I know this was kind of the first adult, as it were, in a way, adult, 2000 AD, but we do get quite an interesting butt shot, don't we? Yeah. As it.
I'm looking at that right
I
just
bet
now,
you are.
and it's only when you said that I realized what I was looking at. Yeah, it's just quite actually the perspective in that shot's not quite right. But
doesn't.
I don't know. It's funny because I just noticed this when we mentioned Ian Gibson there.
Yeah.
This is 1990, and one thing I noticed when I was a kid was that Judge Dredd, early Judge Dredd, was very much based, to me anyway. Well, actually, no, the first couple of Judge Dredds, I think, and no one ever seemed to talk about this. To me, I always thought Judge Dredd was black, because of the way that his physiognomical features in the first few episodes, to me, he looked black,
Right.
and I just assumed he was black. And I know that there's been, I've heard a couple of interviews that kind of talk about that a little bit, but no one ever talks about, whitewashing the character in him. But then I think, certainly as a character, he seemed to be based in a combination of, it was a One-Eyed Jack, and who was in turn based in Dirty
Yeah.
Harry. So in this, I think Judge Dredd is based in Clint Eastwood, but my understanding is that the physical template for Judge Dredd had changed in the 80s to Arnold Schwarzenegger, particularly the way that what's his face, Ian Gibson drew him.
Okay.
All of a sudden, Dredd much more muscular. The chin gets so much bigger, and it wasn't just an emphasis in cartooning and caricature. It was like a different physical template, which I think maybe fits in with the excessive 80s. And I think Arnold Schwarzenegger actually probably ties in a lot of the with Marvel and Image in the 80s as well. If you look at the physicality of characters, all of a sudden get dialed up to 11. Yeah. Because that's
I think that's worth mentioning, because this book definitely feels like the sort of cocaine blizzard movies of the 80s and 90s, doesn't it? It feels like the, you know, Rutger Hauer Detective of the Week or Sci-Fi Book of the Week out of Full Moon or something like that. There's it's almost an English version of what was about to happen in Image Comics, isn't it? A British version, rather. It's a lot of splash panels. It's not a huge emphasis on people's faces. There's whole pages where we just get like little outlines and shadows and stuff. I prefer the personality. I don't think he makes the face as interesting as I'd like. I think perhaps is the reason.
Well, I mean, some of the faces, like some of the times where you see Beanie, his eyes are really close together, and it's like this tiny wee face and this massive head.
Right, yeah.
And like there's one of it, like, you know, when he comes across America and she's the prostitute and she turns around and her face in that panel is horrendous.
Yeah, it looks like a geezer, doesn't it?
I mean, call him a geezer. Yeah. It's not good. And I'm not slagging his art, because he's a lovely guy, because I met him a few times and I do like his art and quite a lot of things. But there are moments in this where you're like, what the fuck are you thinking there?
Yeah.
It's quite interesting you say that, because I've not read... So I got the... I need to mention this as well. So I ordered the Hachette book, because there's a few different versions of this. I don't think it's in print just now either. So there's a new version coming out in September.
Okay.
And I got the Hachette version off eBay for £7. And whoever sold me this, thank you for the excess wheat and tobacco you left the rest in the pages, which was good
hell.
When I was reading that fell out. So thanks for that. It was several years old. It stank. But looking at the second story, and I'd heard this before when they were talking about how his style had changed because it wasn't painted. That's not a style. That's a medium. His style has changed, because when I was reading it, I was like, holy shit, it's like a blend of Barry Kitson, Steve Dillon, and Esquerra. And it's quite interesting when you see the way that he does faces, quite open, and then I can see what you're saying about the eye spacing as well, James. That eye spacing is correct. It's just because of the construction of the face being quite wide, and I think that's because of he's letting the colours do a lot of the work.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a beautiful page, and there's no page numbers, this I can't actually tell you, but it's at the end. Wait a minute, 1, 2, 3, 4, the fourth page from the end, and there's a close up on, well, let's just call it America just now, about to sing.
Yeah.
And I think that's beautiful, but there's some kind of rules that this goes against. And I've had arguments with other folk about this, that I admit I can't remember who said it, that there's you know, rules like the kind of how you do the flow of a comic page and stuff like that. But I remember a rule saying that you've always got to draw at least one full figure in a page so that the reader gets their money's worth.
Okay.
And
that doesn't always happen in this, does it? Or at least it does, but perhaps just from a distance.
A
Yeah.
The layouts leave a lot of negative space, and that doesn't always necessarily work.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's just because, again, I mean, you mentioned it earlier on, the pressures of doing a fully painted strip on these kind of deadlines must be horrific.
And it was a high-pressure one as well, because it was going to lead off. You know, it was in that first issue.
He was pretty young as well.
Yeah, must have been, yeah.
Because we still, I remember...
I've got two things. One thing I want to ask before we get to the thorny subject at the end of it, which I want to talk a little bit about, I think. But I wanted, if you can go to the first page, you know, the splash page of Dredd standing on the flag. I want to mention the lettering. And if you look at the outline of the boxes and the spacing of the words, that first page is a mess, man. It's the boxes are all wrong. There's whole big white spaces in some of them.
Some of them look like they're... Like they're if you're fucking, I can't remember the word for it, but you know, some of the lines look like they're right bang onto the side, and some of them are off center a bit, and
it's not justified, and I don't mean it's not centered.
Yeah.
Annie Parkhouse is like really experienced. Yeah. I wonder if was this when he was making the transition to digital letter.
I wondered that. It's a strange, isn't it? Because the lettering itself seems a little bit squashed within some of the boxes on occasion. It's not quite what I was used to. Yeah, just thought I'd mention that.
Do you think this? Sorry. Do you think this kind of like heralded? Because obviously the start of the 90s was when a lot of people switched off from 2000.
Yeah.
And because of stories like, you know, your Big Daves and your, you know, the Spice Girls, kind of whatever, you know, and had lots of like women on the covers and stuff. Do you think this is kind of like the herald of that? Do you think this is the beginning of that?
Yeah.
To an extent, because like you're, it's kind of
I'm flabbergasted.
2000 AD to the extreme.
Yeah,
you know,
no, I agree, man.
Some of the art is like everyone's muscly and
I'm actually absolutely flabbergasted. This is thought of as so fondly. I think maybe part of it is that intro because it's so iconic, and you know Wagner writes well in that. But I think to me, there's so many other books. You know, Judge Child, Apocalypse War. You know, there's so many Boing. There's so many other things I just enjoyed more, and I reread it for the first time really since I read it in the magazine, and I thought, what's all the fuss about?
Can I just say something about the lettering?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
What I think it might be as well is if you look at, there's no hard panel borders. They use the colour just to show the outline of the panel, and I think maybe that's what makes the lettering stand out more, is that there's hard borders, like there's complete borders around the narration boxes and also the word balloons as well, whereas because it's fully coloured you didn't necessarily need to do that. And it stands out, for example, when you've got the kids who, again, I've got purple hair, so that's purple colour scheme, picking in Benny when he's a kid, when they're saying spug face, that's not within word balloons, and it's almost part of that. It still looks, in fact, it is digital, but there's no hard border around it. If you see what I mean, it's kind of just white. It's negative space essentially, the lettering. So maybe if they'd done that, I think it would have looked.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe it wouldn't have jarred as much.
British comics have historically have always had a little bit of a problem with the lettering. At one point, it looked like someone was using a typewriter on the page, didn't it? I think in some British weeklies.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, but. I don't know. I just kind of. I know Annie Parkhouse is, you know, a really good letter and well respected, and still, I think, still busy in the prog. I think, but it's just. I don't know. I just. I think part of it might be the fact that Dredd's not is barely in it. Like we said, he acts a little bit out of character. But let's get to the end. So in 1990, long before perhaps gender politics were quite the hot button subjects as they are today, we get. In a way, we get a gender swap, don't we, at the end of this? I'd forgotten it happened, and it came as a bit of a surprise when I read it.
I'd actually totally forgotten it happened as well, to be honest with you.
I didn't know what happened. It kind of instantly made me think about The Crying Game, and I was surprised to find out The Crying Game came out in 1992, 2 years after that.
Yeah.
And I was like, so I just assumed it was based in that, and I was like, God, that's a cheap thing. And then I was like, there's... to me, it surprised me as well, because from a story reason, it came out of nowhere. There was no kind of hint of anything.
Yeah, there was no, as we are used to now, you know, heavily leaning on the theme on the way into it. There was nothing, none of that was there.
To be fair, though, it kind of completes his obsession with her.
Yes, that's the point.
Because the whole comic's about his obsession, isn't it? It's not a love story. It's his obsession. That's how she manages to manipulate him the way that she does to give him the money. That's why it's not a love story, even though at the start it says this is a love story. But it's not a love story. It's Benny's love story in his head.
Yeah.
But it's this weird obsession thing that he has for her, and that's why he takes over her body, obviously. But
that's how he makes his,
as you say,
that's how he makes his deception right, doesn't it? That's how he's, you know, when he's the Judas of the story at the end there, isn't he? That's how it's made right in his head as well.
I think it's played for a cheap twist, to be honest, because obsession just isn't the same as gender dysphoria. It's just completely different. I mean, it's, you know, there's no, he's not confused about his gender or sexuality through it. I mean, he's very openly heterosexual through it. Yeah. You know, it's made clear for the story. And you know, there's not, I mean, this is something I know we live in much more complicated times, and it's the same if you went back to Judge Dredd's always had this. If you go back and you look at the fatties or the muties, I mean, you're just... and again, you can hold up a lens to say, right, okay, it's in there as satire. Really?
Veritable minefield, isn't it? It's a minefield.
Yeah, map. I mean, sometimes it feels more like taking easy shots.
Do you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of when Scott Bakula was a lady in Quantum Leap, which that's what it reminded me of. Yeah, almost like a cheap gimmick in a way. You're right. Yeah. It's a strange one, isn't it? It's really strange that happens, I think.
Yeah, because it doesn't make sense in the story, but it is. It's almost like to show his obsession, but as you say, it's not. They could have showed it in other ways. He could have had her dead body, like, mummified in the corner of the room or something. Like, you know, there could have been lots of other things you could have done that I think would have been more shocking, because I don't know if it was meant to shock or not, or just be like, oh my God, he's messed up. but it doesn't play in well with the guilt factor. Oh, I feel really guilty about this person dying, so I'm going to take over her body because I can't sing anymore because I've got this thing, even though I've already spoken about how they're going to use the voice box and actually make my voice come out of that voice box, but it won't be as good. So yeah, it's, you know, it doesn't make thematical sense. Oh, just to say, by the way, Annie Parkhouse is currently working on the End of Days story in 2000 AD and The Out in 2000 AD, so she is still working on it, because I just picked up the latest one.
Good stuff. So. Now, the next, obviously, we're getting towards the end now, so I can ask you guys about a couple of your projects. But do you think it's this is a book? This is a story that led off the Hachette series, as I understand it. Is that right? The Dread Hachette.
Yes.
Yeah. Volume one, wasn't it? I think so. It's clearly very well thought of. Does it still hold up for you guys?
Ben came with a free bag of weed inside it, so I don't know if that was officially part of the
sales
technique.
Yeah.
I'll be honest. I mean, I think John Wagner's an absolute legend.
Yeah, I think he's great. Yeah.
I think Colin McNeil is he's a great artist. I don't think this is their best work. I think this followed a trend in comics from 1986 onwards, this grim and gritty, overbearing grim and grittiness in comics that followed, like, Watchmen. I think 1986 as well was the Punisher miniseries as well. Okay. So the way that, you know, all of a sudden there wasn't necessarily a satirical element or even a cautionary tale element to gun-toting characters. There was an element of coolness to it. And I definitely think as James said earlier on, this isn't the Dread of 2000 AD. The tone is completely different. And I think maybe that tone will change. So going from that kind of humour-laden satire of fascism to something that's nightmarish, hyper-real sort of fascism, but also political. Well, I think that was always there, but there was a satirical element to it. This was much more serious, with a capital S. And I think, because of that, it's less sophisticated. It's just it seems, I don't want to say less clever, but it's just less sophisticated, because, you know, you're not having to come up with ways of not diluting the message, but
to me it was a little.
It's just too
It was a little bit on the nose. Is the phrase I was going to use, but yeah.
I mean, the last page in particular, it's just like, really fucking laying it on thick, like really hammering it home. It's just like, fuck you, that we're not saying he's a hero, this guy is a fascist. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, right, okay.
And
to be a little bit
blokey for a second, you'll forgive me, she ain't all that, really. She fucks him over, she's rude to him all the time, and do you know what I mean? I've seen better looking girls on the checkout at Tesco's.
She's got a very 90s jaw. Yeah. You know what I mean? That kind of 90s jaw where the artists do the very square jaw. She's got a very square jaw.
Yeah, she's quite scary as well.
See at the end, actually, and it's quite interesting the way that McNeil drew America at the end. The character that when she walks, when again, I'm very conscious of, obviously, there's a huge trans rights just now. There's obviously a lot of very high profile stuff. So, you know, but again, with this character, I'm not meaning to be disrespectful if I say she or he, because it is just never set out how at any point that Beanie self-identifies as a woman in any way.
Okay.
He just physically inhabits a body out of guilt, and that to me is a complete misunderstanding. And in today's, again, more enlightened and complicated times, it's just it really stuck out like a sore thumb to me. But when Benny in America's Body is coming on the stage, I just thought he was dressed up as America. I didn't think he was in her body because the musculature.
Okay, yeah, I get
Like the shoulders.
Yeah, he does that with shadows a lot,
chest.
Doesn't he, as well? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it does look like, and again, the square jaw, as James has said, it does look like more masculine features, which is different to the design of America, who's a very slight figure earlier on. So all of a sudden, she is really quite muscular.
Yeah. I think
so. That confused me a little bit, but that was tidied up in the narration.
I think we negotiated the seas of controversy there quite well. I think we did all right there.
Just to say, when Hatchett done the 2000 AD Ultimate Collection, I think it's a much better picture of what 2000 AD is about, because I've actually got the first four issues in front
right.
of me. So, not the Judge Dredd one, because as you say, it's a weird one to have, because it is one of those stories that it's not as well versed in the time now. When you put it in the time that's going around just now and what life is like now, or what, 5 years ago, whenever the Hatchett collection came out, it doesn't sit as well. But okay, so the Ultimate 2000 AD collection, issue one that came out was the Horned God. Issue two was Halo Jones.
Right.
Issue three was oddly Shakara.
Okay.
Like the first Shakara story, that big robot. And then the fourth one was Strontium Dog, the Killer Conspiracy, which is one of the Carlos Esquizera and John Wagner ones. So it's much more what 2000 AD is about because that's the thing about, that's a weird one for Hatchett to make the first.
I wonder whether there was something
Judge
to do
Dead
with,
one.
You know, for me, if it was me, I'd probably do the Judge Child quest straight away. But I suppose that came out a couple of years before, didn't it? When they used the stuff that they couldn't use before because of copyright.
Maybe it was to do with the Essential Collections. You know, the Essential Collections were coming out and they didn't want to, because it's true. A while before America came out. So maybe they're like, well, that's just happened and that. So if we bring that out in this really nice hardback paperback, it won't work as well because it's just come out in this Essential Collection number, was it number four, number six? Is number four not the Apocalypse War?
Yeah.
I can't remember. I've got loads of them anyway, but I can't.
Yeah, I've got a few of them.
I wonder if they brought this out first because it was in colour.
Maybe, man, yeah.
I think it's strange because, I mean, it references the Apocalypse Wars in it. And to me, the Apocalypse Wars, it follows on from Block Wars as well. Orlok to me, bloody hell, and you've got Ball and Dart.
There's loads of Esquira stuff in there. You can imagine that. I always say that's one of my favourite Esquira moments is when those big sort of battleships are coming over the city, and it was the longest run at the time, and it would have made. Yeah, but you're right though. I think you might be right, James, because that would have been. I know they were re-releasing their essentials or whatever the case files as if they're in colour, weren't they at one point? And I wonder whether they'd hit,
it went into colour.
Whether they'd hit a point where it was. Yeah, it's an interesting one.
I mean, they'd already done it. I mean, this was, I think the thing about the Mega Collection is that it's thematic rather than sequential.
Yeah.
So you're not going to do one of the early ones. You're right, they've already done that in the case files. And then from a marketing point of view, they want to make it different. I don't know. I mean, those early case files, I'm really lucky because it's like, fuck, if you've never eaten pizza before, the first time you eat pizza, unless you're, I don't know, gluten or lactose intolerant, you're going to be like, well, you'll never forget pizza.
Yeah. are good. Oh
God,
yeah, they're really good. I remember I bought, after seeing the Dread movie, I ran down the road to a bookshop that's still open and bought volume 10 and fucking read it in a night. There's some really good stuff. It really brings it back. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Right, guys,
The 80s Dread was the best Dread.
Sorry, man.
Sorry, but the 80s Dread was the best Dread. I think a lot of the just 80s 2000 AD in general. I mean, I still read 2000 AD now, and I still really enjoy it, but there is something special about 80s 2000 AD. And it's not because you were a kid when you read it, and it's not some, nostalgia thing, because when you read it now, it still holds up really well.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Dread your favourite strip in
2000 AD. What's that, mate?
It's Dread your favourite strip in 2000
AD. Nemesis. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I'd say Slain.
Okay, cool.
I'd say Slain for me.
Really? Yeah. I'd probably say Strong Dog or Robo Hunter.
Well,
Nemesis. Let's have a fight next.
Yeah,
let's
see. Yeah, bring knives. Nemesis has always been, because I loved it before I met Pat, and then it turned out that Torquemada was based on our mutual housemaster at boarding school, and
amazing.
It's just incredible. I think the I love it all, but the O'Neill stuff is just. And I think when I interviewed Pat at the 40th, I didn't tell him I was going to ask this question. I said, what's your favourite strip you've ever written for 2000 AD? And there's a real moment, if you watch it, I think it's on YouTube, you can find it. There's a real moment where he pauses and he says, Nemesis. I'm like, wow, okay.
But do you even like the ones where it was those weird photo
ones?
Oh,
no, not that one. That one got like a bit those? Dark, didn't it? Yeah, that got a bit weird.
What was that, an annual or something like that, with the weird yeah. photo fucking Nemesis?
Yeah, basement in like, Colchester.
You know, I'm Nemesis. Yeah. Are you? No, fucking yeah. hell. Yeah.
It's like someone read Doomlord and thought, that's a really good idea. Yeah. Really?
Someone went Sergeant Street.
It looked
Street
like a fucking
Eagle
video,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
Trying to take over the world one office block at a time.
Right, guys, we're going to pause there and we're going to do our sponsor.
Cool.
If you can pause for the sponsorship ad, please. It's our big sponsor. Yeah, it's paying us lots of money. Do you like jumping to conclusions or maybe spreading nasty rumours or even just being downright horrible online without a care for the person's career, reputation or even their family life? Then why not join Twitter?
Yay!
There you go. It's our current sponsor. Very pleased to have them on board.
That's amazing, yeah.
I got uncomfortable there for a second because I thought you were describing James's personality.
Well, anyone wants to sponsor me, I'll do a sponsorship. You know, anyone. Apart from Comicsgate.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
I'd actually just like to say that I do love James and I value his friendship and collaboration, and I didn't mean that. I don't want to hurt you, James.
Right, so that's leading on from that, though. What are you guys working on? So, should we start with you, Mr. Pete? What are you working on at the moment?
It took me a wee while to figure out you actually meant me there because no one knows
that. It says it on the screen.
I'm nearly finished inking the United Welcome to the Shit Show.
Okay.
Which is a collection of my non-award-winning comic.
We're all in that boat, my friend.
I getting through that, and so a Kickstarter I'm looking at. I mean, there's no rush for it, but I'm looking to get that out in probably October, November, do that, and I'm really, really pleased with the way it's turned out. I was pleasantly surprised going back through the old comics. I've never reread them, but I was quite surprised. I was like, oh, this is actually all right. But it's the best art I've done. It's the best I can do. The inking's good, but the thing I'm most excited about is I got pin-ups from a few incredibly talented people, and just seeing someone else draw your creations is such a...
What are you most excited about? Sorry, I missed that. I missed the...
I was just about to get some very talented writers... I've written features like Alistair Black has written forward. Yeah. I can't think who else has done anything.
Some
And a certain Tony Osmond has written something for it as well, which is great. I'm probably going to rope in one of my collaborators. I need to speak to him about that after this recording. about doing something. And at first I was like, when it was a forward, I thought, God, this, how fucking arrogant are you, a forward and a... afterward in it, and I was just like, no, it means a lot.
I had a laugh writing that, man. As you know, so I kept sending you stupid phrases I was including in it. Yeah,
it's really, really funny, and it was just, I was like, well, there goes the PG-13, but never mind.
Well, you employ me, you know what you're gonna get.
Yeah, your books, one of your books is gonna be a PG-13.
I knew what I was gonna get, but
it's looking good, man. And I reread the original.
You can feel proud of something.
I reread the original series this week and really enjoyed it. Or just before I wrote it, I thought I'd reread that. And I think it still stands up really well, man. I think it's I'm looking forward to reading this new one.
You need to remember as well. There's nothing to be ashamed of being proud of something you've done
at all.
You know what I mean? You should be proud because it's a great book and it's taken a long time to get there and it's become the divided and then it's a massive behemoth work, so you should be fucking proud of it.
I think there's a fine line between being proud of it, which you're right, you should well be, James, but being American. There's that fine line, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly.
Put it on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
You see, I like that we've managed to offend an entire country and anyone that works at Tesco. Oh no, you did compliment anyone that works at Tesco.
Yeah, I've been on a few dates with girls from Tesco, my friend. Yeah.
Okay. And an entire gender as well. That was
They know what they get when they come in here. What about you, James? What are you working on at the moment, dude?
So I am working, obviously, Transylvania Nights with Johnny. We're working on the second issue of that. which is a behemoth of a second issue, and it's going to be really good. I've
Looking forward
got
to that.
I've started working on City of Lost Souls issue 7, even though I said I wasn't going to do it, but I decided I really got a good idea and I wanted to work on it. We've got the graphic novel hopefully coming out soon. I'm talking really fast for some reason.
Sorry.
Let me think. Can't be AO7. I got the thumbnails through for it this week, and I realised I'd made a massive error in the script, so I'm going to go back and fix that, and then that'll be
That's the
coming out
second
soon.
issue, yeah.
Yeah, that's a second issue,
Yeah,
yeah.
good
So,
stuff.
because it, basically the pacing doesn't work right, so I'm having to go back and
Okay.
fix it, which
Good
was my
man.
bad. Let me think. I've got Mean Motherfucker, which is a book I'm doing with Pedro, done a Little Girl
Ah.
Black artwork. That's been out with him for a while, so I don't know when that'll come out. And that's basically about a guy who's a mob enforcer who decides he basically wakes up and he's all confused because his meds have went awry, and he's got PTSD and stuff, and it's about him going after the people that he works for. So it's kind of like a tongue-in-cheek kind of exploitation thing. And I've got a book about neo-Nazis being killed by werewolves
Nice.
as well. I think that's pretty much it. Yeah.
Neo-Nazis or just
You
Nazis?
know, I just
Oh, okay,
neo-Nazis,
bringing
because
it up to date,
it's a
yeah.
basically neo-Nazis do some robberies and they all meet up in the country, but on the way back to the country they run over a kid and they're like, oh my God, there's a kid, and they get it in the car and they take it back to this country base. And it turns out the kid's part of a werewolf pack, and the werewolf pack come and destroy them all. Just
Oh,
because I
that
wanted to
sounds
write
good.
something about Nazis getting fucked up, you know what I
Yeah,
mean? It's,
I like that, yeah.
yeah, I think that's everything. I'm working on some screenplays just
Oh.
now as well for a company that's working in. It's a German company. It's a production company here that's working with a German company, and I've done like two short films for them, and I'm working on one that they're trying to make a TV
Oh,
show as
nice
well.
work, man.
So.
Good stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
That could be nice, but I might not. I might
Well,
never.
wait.
I'm as far as I'm very aware that it probably will never happen, but I'm trying to make them as low budget as possible, the short stories. So even if we just get those done, that
Good
would be
stuff,
nice,
guys.
you know.
What genre is that, James?
What?
What genre is that? The TV stuff?
Well, it's black comedy. Basically, it's like a black comedy. There's going to be some horror in there as well, because I'm trying to do lots of different short films to show everything we can do, but the main ones of interest now are just black comedy.
Oh, nice. Look forward to that, man.
Right.
Fucking hell. Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll be a rock. Well, you're already a rock
It
star, but
never
you'll be a
fucking
rock star
tells
with
me
money
anything,
next
does
time I see
it?
you. Yeah.
No, and then I've got
Yeah.
a band
Yeah.
as well.
What's
We've got
going on
a
with
band
them?
doing shit
What
as well.
we got to look after you?
Well, we lost our fucking drummer. We've got a new drummer, and we're going on tour, and definitely in January and possibly in September if things open up. So
Good.
you know, we'll see how
Good.
things go.
I'm up in Scotland in the next few months, so I'll call in on you. Yeah,
Why are
yeah,
you?
yeah. Yeah, I'll talk to you after it, but yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing you, your band live. Yeah.
You're getting fucking sprayed with the garden hose before you come near
Play
my
that.
house, Tony.
I
Coming from the
see.
hotbed of COVID-19.
Not where I live, my friend.
We're
Not
not
where
allowed
I
to
live.
speak. We're not allowed to speak to English people anymore. Apparently, this is where we seem to be going just now as a protected
I
species
live
of
in the
Scotland.
countryside. Anyway, your lady's been fudging the figures, I hear. That's what the news said.
Excuse me, Mab. Oh, I think my
Oh, who's
wife.
that
I
woman from the
was
Crankies? What's her name?
like, what? My wife's not been fudging anything.
Good-o. All right, guys, thanks for that. How can we let's start with you, Johnny. Where can people find you and buy your books, most importantly?
Oh God, you always ask me this, I never bloody know. I'm as Cannon Hill Comic on Twitter, Cannon Hill underscore comics on Instagram, and Johnny Cannon on Facebook. So if you just Google non-award winning Johnny Cannon, actually don't do that, because if you Google Johnny Cannon, you'll probably get there's some book series about someone called
Oh,
Johnny
okay.
Cannon, which is not. So, and don't pretend you don't
I
Google me all
do.
the
You
time,
know I do.
Tony. Look at
I look you up
images.
on X
Is
Hamster.
this what I, is this what I say? Sorry, is this what I say? I'm award winning.
Yes, you
Can I
can. We're
say
waiting for
that
that
now that
one.
Johnny's gone on
Yeah, I
as
know
well?
you
Yeah,
are.
that's it.
Johnny,
Constantly.
allow
Any
James to talk. He's award winning.
Absolutely.
So, where can we find you? Where can we
Oh,
find you, dude?
fuck, man. Sorry, I totally interrupted again. It's grandmasterwook.co.uk, I think, and it's Grandmaster Rook on Twitter, and all my shit's on Comic House. For free if you've got the app, so you should fucking check it out. I'm going to put Can't Be AO7 because it's not on at the moment, but I'm going to put it on this weekend because I've been meaning to do it. I've just been busy with work, all like, you know, NHS and that. Yeah. So, but yeah, so grandmasterrook.co.uk, I think that's pretty much everything, or it's all on Comic House, and the band's called Cheburn Dread, if you fancy listening to us on Spotify.
I don't listen to any music made after 1981, and I make an exception for your band because they're good dog walking music. Yeah, keeps me going. Yeah, good stuff, man.
Oh,
yeah.
Thanks, man.
All right, guys. Well, I'm going to say goodbye to you now. You can find my comics at tributepress.bigcartel.com for all your not safe for work needs. And I'll say goodbye now, and we should continue talking in a second. Cheers, lads. Thanks for that.